authentic communication is incredibly important. And as we were starting Inseparable, if you think about the moment we were in May of 2020, when we're all at home, and then we started working in states and working at the federal level and with a really small community of people around Inseparable. And so it was just a casual email that said, here's what we're doing. Here's what seems to be working. Here's where we've fallen flat a few times. And we've just expanded that as we've gone along, but we've not changed the style a bit, even as we've grown. And so this year we're in 18 states pursuing legislation. We're working at the federal level, but I send out a quarterly update to the stakeholders that will say the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it's meant to be a conversation. But what we found is that instead of a lot of slick materials all the time, people really value the idea that they're having a conversation with us. And they'll reply back and they'll ask questions. And it's a great tool for me to also understand what's resonating and what's not. But at the end of the day, we believe in, you know, being really transparent about what we're doing, because what we're fighting for is so important. And you just have to tell people this is what's going on. And I just do that as a conversation more than anything else.
Have you ever noticed that some of the best ideas come from unexpected places? Your next breakthrough may come from a leader facing similar challenges, but in a completely different sector. Welcome to Chief Influencer. I'm your host, Anthony Schopp. Join us as we explore how today's successful leaders inspire, influence, and connect with others. Chief Influencer is a production of Social Driver and the Communications Board, who have teamed up to spotlight how great leaders and communicators are making their impact in the world. This episode is brought to you by the George Washington University's College of Professional Studies. With in-person and online programs, ranging from master's degrees in public relations strategy to certificate programs in digital communications, GW offers more than just the credentials to help working professionals get ahead. It prepares them to be leaders in their field. As a proud GW graduate myself, I can attest that faculty members combine academic rigor with real-world lessons that can't always be found in textbooks. Check out cps.gwu.edu for more information. I'm so excited to introduce today's guest, Bill Smith. Bill is the founder and CEO of Inseparable, an organization focused on making mental health policy a priority, and which has had numerous successes regarding mental health policy at both the state and federal levels. Here are three things I think you should know about Bill. Number one, Bill's also currently chairman of Civitas Public Affairs Group, which he co-founded, and where he advises philanthropists, foundations, and donor collaboratives on a wide range of policy objectives, as well as national nonprofit organizations seeking to advance progressive policies. Number two, prior to founding Civitas, Bill served as the national political director and deputy executive director for GIL Action, working across the country to build political power for the LGBT community, resulting in marriage equality and other key policy wins. And number three, Inseparable, which Bill now leads as CEO, actually began as a national campaign that he launched, which is focused on mental health. And Bill just recently transitioned to the role of full-time CEO. So I'm excited to dive into today's conversation. Bill, welcome to Chief Influencer.
Thanks so much, Anthony. It's great to be with you.
Well, I have to say, yeah, I've known you for a little bit. I am really inspired by the work that you have done over your career and what you're doing now. And we have so much to talk about, but I thought we could start with your current role as CEO of Inseparable. And I know that when you're trying to advance policy at the state level, the national level, there are a lot of different stakeholders that you have to keep in mind and that you have to influence to make those things happen. So I wondered if you could talk about some of the different stakeholders that are really important to you and that who you as a leader have to influence to achieve these outcomes.
I'm happy to. We launched Inseparable 4 years ago, just a few months into global pandemic, specifically around trying to advance mental health policy in the United States. And we started with the name Inseparable because the health of our minds can't be separated from the health of our bodies. Yet, if you look at how we've treated mental health as an issue in our country over the last 30, 40 years, we've done anything but that. We've actually separated mental health out in different systems and with stigma. And so what we wanted to do with Inseparable was bring together all the stakeholders who are working on the issue. Very clearly, mental health is something that impacts all of us one way or another, whether it's personal, whether it's someone in our family, we all have mental health. And so one audience is really all of us to talk about mental health, but then also to really focus in on policymakers, because there's so much about how we deal with mental health as a country that has to do with public policy, whether it's budgets, whether it's rules around insurance coverage and systems change, all of it impacts our mental health. And so we focus really clearly on bringing people in to share their own stories, to influence policymakers to change the policy that we think needs to improve to advance mental health in our country.
A little bit later, we'll talk more about some of those policy changes and how you made them happen. But maybe to take a step back, I think it's so fascinating that Inseparable began as a campaign that you launched, as part of your company, and now you've decided to transition to do that full time. Civitas is really focused on research. From my understanding, research is such a powerful, maybe an essential tool to influence policy, to influence the public. And I know over the time that you co-founded and built that business, that Civitas has been instrumental in some major issues, such as marriage equality. So maybe let's kind of go back in time a little bit, talk about the creation of Civitas and some of the key things that you've learned when it comes to influencing policy and influencing the public through research.
Yeah, I'm a huge believer and devotee of research as a tool in the public policy process. And I think it started when I was working in campaigns right out of college in the electoral world and understanding polling and how it helps you figure out the core messages to focus on with candidates. But when I started working in the marriage equality movement, that's when I really dug into research, because we were hitting a wall. When I started, we were in the 30% public support and approval for same-sex marriage. And it was really hard to move that needle. So we did lots and lots of research working with different organizations in the marriage movement. And there were all these debates, even within the folks doing research, about exactly how to do it and the types of questions to ask. And, for me, one of the big learnings was to go deeper on the qualitative side and talk to people about what they thought about their own marriage. And I got to a point where, in a focus group, you could ask the question, marriage is a collection of 1,047 different rights and benefits and privileges. How many of you think of your marriage like that? And most people would be silent, but of course one person might raise their hand, and then you would say, well, don't tell your spouse about that, because that's probably not why they're married to you, is from a rights and benefits. It's because of love and commitment. And that's something that we learned from the research process, that we were getting the messaging wrong. We even published books in the early days of the marriage movement that listed out those 1,047 different rights, including things like fishing licenses and, tax and inheritance and things that, many of them are important, but it's just not how people relate to their marriage. And so, what we did was over time realize we've got to change how we talk about this away from rights and benefits and into love and commitment. Because that's why people decide to get married, is because they love the other person and they want that commitment recognized by their friends and family and society around them. And when we did that, it completely changed our ability to impact the public policy conversation, whether it was legislatures, whether it was state ballots, and ultimately, of course, at the Supreme Court. And so for me, it was such a gift to be a part of a movement that spent a lot of time and resources on research, because it was so critical in helping us get where we needed to go. And at Civitas, that's something that we've really focused on, is understanding how do you unpack what people think about an issue, what's underneath baseline opinions, and really try to understand that. And we've applied that to a number of different issues, from climate change to mental health. And, you know, so I'm always a believer that when you start a major project and try to change significant public policy, the first thing you've got to do is listen, and research is how we do that.
Yeah, when you shared that example around marriage equality of the 1,047, you know, benefits compared to love and commitment, kind of reminds me of there was a juxtaposition I saw once of a couple advertisements from back in the day of computers. And one was, I don't know if it was Compaq or IBM or something like that, but it listed all of these technical specifications of a computer. And then the other one was, I'm pretty sure it was iMac. I know it was an Apple product. And it was just like focused on, it was just a few words, and it was really focused on, you know, the design and the ease of use. And when you look at the result of that, when I hear you say love and commitment, it's kind of like, oh, no brainer, right? What perfect words. But I know that if you just put people in a room and you ask them to simplify, you know, different people would have different words and different phrases, and they would resonate. So you have to, there's a process to hone that down and to figure out, as you're doing surveys and qualitative interviews, what language to use and how that's going to influence people. And I wonder if you could share a little bit more about that, because I think leaders, they're not only dealing with this externally the way you are with policy in the public, but even inside their own organizations. You know, maybe they want to tell the story of the, you know, it's a great place to work, or the impact that the company's making, or if they're in government, you know, what, how they're serving the people. And sometimes they may struggle to figure out, how do I get to that process to come up with that simple overarching message without a litany of benefits? I don't know if you could say more about that, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I think, you know, one of the hardest things is getting to real simplicity in communication. And if there's something that that movements tend to do too much of, it's over-explain in a technical context. One of my great mentors was a guy named Bill O'Connor, who's a communications specialist in Alabama. And we were traveling together one day, and we were at the airport, and I was trying to talk to him about how we were going to communicate something. And he looked over and saw there were all these airline mechanics on strike outside the entrance to the airport. And it said, you know, UAW or local number 472, you know, wants better benefits or whatever. And he said, "You see that over there? That's bad messaging." He said, "If I were those guys, that sign would say mechanics on airline mechanics on strike. Wouldn't fly today if I were you." Mm-hmm. And it was just like, wow, that's a totally different way to, you know, put the punch in a message and really get it into a language that the normal people out there would use. And so that's one of the things I strive to do at Inseparable, and certainly have done through the years at Civitas, is make sure we're using plain language to talk to people in a way that they talk with their friends and their family. And that's something that you have to work at in the policy arena, because sometimes it's a lot of jargon.
Well, let's even talk about a specific phrase. So if you roll back not too, you know, far back, gay marriage, same-sex marriage were phrases that might have been used. But you were part of the process and the team. I know there were a lot of others involved too, that really said marriage equality is the right message that we should use. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. There were a lot of people out there would say gay marriage. And we used to sort of joke that that was sort of like when people would call the copier the Xerox machine. You're not necessarily, you know, say go Xerox something. You're not necessarily going to change all the vocabulary that people use. But some of the insights from the research told us that people on the left, the framing of equality mattered a lot to them. And, you know, so marriage equality became a pretty easy way to talk about it, because it implied, right, that there's a segment of our population that is not being treated as equal. Now, on the other side of the aisle, if you're talking to conservatives about the issue of marriage, on some issues, there are folks on the right that wouldn't necessarily agree with the concept of equality. But when you talked about freedom, that brought another element into the conversation. And so that's, you know, the biggest marriage campaign in our country was called Freedom to Marry, which was around the basic premise that everyone should have the freedom to marry the person that they love. And that resonated a lot with conservatives who believed in notions of individual freedom. So, you know, depending on who you were talking with, you might shift a little here or there, but they're both pretty core concepts that make it easy to access what we're trying to get at.
Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you have this research and you have the data, the quantitative and qualitative, and you believe, okay, this is going to be the winning way of saying it. But then you have stakeholders, maybe it's the people hiring you or their board, or maybe it's a wing of their supporters that just don't like that. And it's not necessarily because they have the data. It's just because they don't like it. Does that happen?
All the time. And in the marriage movement, when we were filming ads for ballot initiatives, we found that in many instances, people wanted to hear from parents or grandparents. And, you know, in Maine, there was this brilliant ad that was around a gay firefighter, and it was all the other guys down at the station house talking about he was just the same as them. And you know, what we used to say is many times when you're doing an ad for a campaign that has both a base element and a turnout element, if you play some of the persuasion ads for the base, they don't like it. And it's because that ad is not aimed at them. And you have to think about the different audiences and what they needed to see. And so that was a very real dynamic in the marriage movement of figuring out the right messengers for the right audiences at the right time. And yeah, a lot of times the research doesn't always say what you want. I learned the most about research from a guy named Jan van Lohuizen, a Dutch pollster who you know, worked with President George W. Bush and many others across the spectrum. He was meeting with a client one time, and he had his pad with all of the key numbers down, and they were just arguing with him and fighting over the numbers. And he just ripped up the paper on the pad and goes, "What do you want the numbers to be? Because we can have a different conversation if you're not going to believe the data." But I'm a believer. You know, you do have to check to make sure that you've done all your research methodology right. But at the end of the day, you have to listen to research, because it really, if it's done well, it's telling you what people think, and it's telling you what you need to hear, more importantly.
Well, let's talk about research, because I'd love to hear from your perspective how that has changed. I mean, obviously, wasn't too long ago that you'd call people on their landlines. That was probably one of the key ways that research was collected around, you know, public opinion. And now, you know, a lot of people probably don't ever answer their phone if they don't know who's calling. There's online ways to collect research. But then there's also public data sets on social media, for example. And then maybe we introduce AI into the mix as the ability to do something with this stuff. So what are some of the changes you've seen, and what do leaders need to know when it comes to research in today's environment?
You know, I would say that the biggest thing to know is that while methodologies have changed and there are new ways to get research done, the basics haven't entirely changed. And so working with a reputable researcher who has figured out how to grow and change with the times as technology has allowed new methods is still pretty key, because there aren't really easy ways to do some of this. You have to, you know, when you're in the quantitative phase, you really do have to get enough people who have an equal opportunity from the population you're trying to sample to be selected. So you do have to do mixed mode where you're, you know, we're texting some people to see if they'll take the survey. We're calling some people. We're, you know, reaching out with some people online. And there are people who've been working really hard to figure out what's the right ratio of that, so you don't inadvertently miss a population or overrepresent another segment of the population. So what I've found is that there are a lot of people that have been doing this a long time that just figured out how to adapt and change. So I think that's important. The second thing I would say is there are new methods out there that are really exciting that we didn't have before, in especially the qualitative realm, because it used to be when you really wanted to do qualitative, you could do one of two things. You would either pull people in for a group and have a focus group conversation, or you could do, you know, individual or, you know, dyad or triad, two or three people interviews, right? You would just bring people together and have long conversations with them. And there are so many more tools out there now to be able to have people journal over a couple of days or to do groups online. At the end of the day, what's important is, no matter the modality, is you need to be able to unpack someone's thinking, and you need to be able to change your questioning based on what you're hearing, so you really are following it. And one of the tools that I like a lot now is social listening, because it allows you to listen when people are not in a focus group. You know, sometimes when you have 10 or 12 people around the table, you have what's called a desirability bias, where people are trying to say what they think will cause them to fit in that conversation. Versus social listening, what people will put out into the world when they don't know that a researcher is listening. And, you know, you have the ability now to scrape huge amounts of that data and see what's going on in conversations about any given issue over a period of time. And, you know, there are different ways of kind of scoring that and understanding what's behind it, because you have to watch out a little bit with things like AI, because people post with sarcasm and humor and things that are sometimes tricky for, you know, machine learning to fully comprehend. But what I've found is that I wouldn't change everything I'm doing from social listening, but what I could do is understand a little bit about what seems to be driving people to post opinions on different issues. And it can give you a really good kind of phase one of going into a multi-phase research project.
Yeah, I'd love to ask a little more about that, because, you know, one of the things that I hear from a lot of leaders when it comes to like a crisis situation is that, on one hand, sometimes there's something brewing that if you had paid attention to and done social listening, you might have spotted it early. So it can be a really powerful tool. On the other hand, sometimes you have one person who's disgruntled and they suddenly get you know, an outsized influence on what's going on, because people think, oh no, this is, you know, this could go viral or something, when in fact, really it's a nothing, you know, it's just an anomaly. So how do you, as a researcher, take a look? Well, and then let's not also forget that, you know, looking at a platform like X, it's not exactly a microcosm of everything, right? I mean, it tends to have certain types of folks on there you know, probably more extreme points of view, people who like to engage in political arguments, you know, not the average American is using that platform. So how do you use social listening, but then kind of keep in mind all of those things? Because I think that that can give people a sense of whiplash. Okay, well, do I use it? Do I not use it? What do I do? How do I know? And you must have some tips and tricks about how you pay attention to that.
You know, it's everything in moderation is the biggest thing I would say, because, for instance, you're never going to find my mother on social media and be able to understand her opinions about politics or, you know, a particular social issue. But she's a voter every single time the polling place is open. So, it, you know, you raise a really important point of, you know, people say all the time, Twitter's not real life. And that is true. But what you can do is figure out what the noise is and start to detect the signal from the noise through that type of research. And that's what I've found valuable. It also can be real time in a way that traditional polling and research hasn't been. And that was one of the first times I really had a wake up moment, was, you know, 10 or 12 years ago in a political race where, you know, a candidate had answered a question around their illegally employed housekeeper and thought that they answered the question. And then they were going into polling. But when you really looked online, you're like, nope, people aren't buying it. That answer didn't solve the problem. And so there was this time element that social listening was enormously valuable, because you could very quickly figure out this is or isn't going to fly. And polling and traditional research methods aren't that fast. Because you know, even if you're doing a traditional poll, you need multiple days to be able to make sure that you've given everyone an opportunity to be to be surveyed, right? Just from a methodology standpoint. So there are tools like that that make it great, but you can't let that be the only tool in the toolkit. To do research well, you often have to have, you know, multimodal approach to really understand the full picture of what's happening on an issue.
Well, and it's interesting how you can have a strategy that engages on social that might have an impact on what other people think. The same way you said there could be a bias in the room, right, of people trying to fit in. I can think of, you know, watching a halftime show at a Super Bowl and thinking, I thought that was pretty good. And then, you know, looking on social media and a lot of other people didn't like it. And I mean, oh, well, maybe it was as good as I thought. I don't know. You know, and kind of, you start to hear other opinions, and I didn't necessarily have a super firmly held position on it. So I was easily swayed by others. And I would assume that that can happen in these types of issues as well. And why it's so important to build campaigns that are going to mobilize people and get them to share, because, you know, it can have an impact on what that social listening ends up telling us. It can start to skew opinions.
Absolutely. You know, they used to say, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And I think that's really true in communications and issues in the environment we have now, where you really have to be in the conversation and you have to have different voices driving towards the direction you're trying to go. It can't just be one. We're in live stereo now all the time, right? And so you really have to have a lot of players on the field pushing the messaging in the direction you want to go.
Well, so I think it's been 4 years since you launched Inseparable. And that is something that came out of Civitas, but which is now its own 501c3 organization that you serve as the CEO of. Can you talk about the creation of Inseparable? Was it research that drove you to see that there was a gap, or, you know, how did this come to be? And then I do want to really dive into some of the successes that you've already had in such a short time.
Sure. You know, for me, it was personal. I've had a 20 plus year career in public affairs and campaigns. But I started Inseparable for deeply personal reasons. I'm the youngest of three brothers, and my middle brother suffered from severe depression and was diagnosed as bipolar and, lost him to suicide after a really long battle. And it just devastated our family. And, you know, as it has way too many families, and I kind of went through the process of thinking through all the things that made it so hard to get his care right, and thinking about how many other people were having those problems. And so, you know, having advised philanthropists on so many different issues, I did what you can do when you're connected to philanthropists. I started interviewing tons of people and clinicians and advocates and people with lived experience, those that were doing the hard work in the mental health field. And what very quickly became obvious to me was that while there were a lot of brilliant people who understood what we need to do for mental health, there also weren't very many people focused on how do we build the power that we need to change these broken systems, because they all involve the government, they all involve funding and rules. And, you know, when you think about that process, you have to have a real social change movement similar to what we built in the marriage equality space. And so that's why I launched Inseparable, around this concept that we actually need to bring together all of the people with both a really tight and good inside game for what it takes to influence the public policy process, but also an outside game of bringing together all the families. Many of whom have experiences that aren't quite as traumatic as mine and losing someone to suicide. But there are a whole lot who have, far too many who have, but bringing all of those people into a conversation and saying, what do we need to do to change these systems so that we can better take care of ourselves and the people that we care about? Because I think there are people in every single city and state, and, you know, big town, small town, red state, blue state, people want this all over the country. And it's up to us to build a movement to make this kind of change happen.
Absolutely. Okay, so take me back, because it strikes me that in your career, for the most part, someone had come up with a campaign, and then they'd hire you to help move things forward. But in this case, you made a switch and said, I'm going to launch a campaign. Like, I'm going to create something. And I don't know if that's the first time you've ever done that, but obviously it seems like a major milestone. You know, that's a decision to make, right? I mean, that's must be a big moment for you. So could you talk about that?
It is. And, it was it was the intersection of several decades of this work and understanding what needed to be done on a professional level, right? Because I've seen it. I've done it in so many different areas. And then that intersection with the deeply personal of how this impacted me and my family. And so I just had a moment where I said, you have the ability to offer something here. And there are a lot of families that are hurting and that have been through far, far too difficult circumstances based on our broken systems. And you know how to do systems change. So what are you waiting for? And so I just dove in. I had a couple of different funders who believed in the concept, but didn't quite know. And I said, we really need a C3 and a C4 and a PAC, and we need to build out this whole thing that's just focused on political power, because, you know, in the anything touching health, if you think about it, there are lots and lots of powerful interests. But in the mental health space, there are not a ton that are focused on building power for the average family, just like yours and mine. And so that's what really just led me to say, like, this is not just going to happen on its own. We have to build it. And as somebody who's been a campaign manager for years, that's what you do in the campaign world, right? Is we build campaigns to go win things. And that's what the goal was and is with Inseparable.
And you had some big wins already. I mean, short amount of time. Can you talk about your approach as a leader to this work? And then can you talk about some of the outcomes that you've already seen?
You know, I think my approach as a leader is to, number one, be incredibly focused on what you want to do. And there are so many things in the mental health field that you could say that impact mental health, that you could have a list of things to do that was, 40 pages long. But what we said was, let's focus in on three of the core systems and areas that will matter the most in transforming mental health. One is around access to care. We call it the treatment gap, because there are millions of people in our country who are in need of mental health care but aren't getting it. The second is around youth mental health, because we know that when you invest early in children, they have better outcomes around mental health. And then the last is around crisis response systems. So if somebody's worst day shouldn't change the rest of their life because of the type of response we have to people in mental health crisis. So what we did was to just really focus intently on those three areas and say, what are exactly the policies that need to be changed? Where exactly are the decision makers on that? Is it, federal? Is it state? Is it local? And then let's go build campaigns to specifically address those issues and stay focused on that and say, we're not going to get into all of the other conversations that we could get in. We're going to do this. And our job is to deliver wins for those people who need them, for the systems that are impacting them right now. It's not some distant thing in the future. We're laddering up, of course, to some really big wins in the long term. But we believe the way you get there is helping people right now by changing systems in an incremental way.
Can you talk about some of those victories that you've had?
Sure. You know, we focusing on youth mental health in particular, in my home state of Alabama, we hired lobbyists and helped pass a bill that said every school district in the state has to have a mental health services coordinator. A lot of the wealthier districts had that, but, places, small towns didn't necessarily have that or the ability to afford it. So we were proud of that. In Delaware, we passed a bill to put more school psychologists in middle schools. We're going back right now, working on the same thing for high schools in Delaware. In Wyoming, the legislature just passed a $10 million appropriation for school mental health. In Montana, we worked with lobbyists on a $300 million trust fund for mental health. in Illinois and Colorado bills to say that we have to screen students in grade 6 through 12 every year for mental health so we can refer kids to services if they need them. Just like very concrete and tangible things that will impact mental health and people's access to care. And, you know, you'll hear in there are red states and blue states. We think it's incredibly important to be working all over the country for this not to be seen as a blue issue or a coastal issue. This is something that impacts every child and every family in one way or another. And so that's what we're doing, is running a campaign so that we impact policy conversations all over the country.
It's impressive what you've done already in such a short amount of time. And I know to influence policy, you have to kind of speak to the head, you know, the logical side of things, but also speak to the heart and, you know, connect back to people and real stories. And, you know, from what I understand, you all have done a good job of balancing those two. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the strategies or the tactics that Inseparable uses to come at it from both of those angles.
Absolutely. You know, for good public policy change, it is the head and the heart, right? So you have to have, for the head, what is the policy change that we're trying to pursue? What will it actually achieve? What are the stats? What is the measurement for how pervasive a problem is in a particular state? And then how do you then tell the story so that it's not just some clinical idea, it's someone's actual life? And, you know, a couple of examples, because things like school mental health can feel so complicated, there are a lot of different data points in a lot of different places, and we pulled them together into a school mental health report card to say, let's look at all 50 states and exactly what they're doing on all the key elements of school mental health. And things like what's the ratio of how many school psychologists we have available for students? And that's measured for every state. And when you pull all these different things together, it gives you a picture of here's how our state's doing on the data front and how we rank against other states on these various pieces. That's really important to be able to have a conversation with lawmakers that has kind of a scorecard approach, if you will. But then you have to combine that with stories of parents saying, this is what was going on with my child. This is how hard it was for us to find the right professional at the right time. And it's that combination of things. And then layered on top of that, a really laser-focused campaign. We go in and we hire the very best lobbyist that you can have in a state, not just necessarily somebody who could explain how a bill works, but who can help you get a bill on a governor's desk, right? So it's taking those different elements of the statistics and the research and the things on the head side, the stories on the heart side, but then packaging them into a very, very focused campaign that's determined to win.
Yeah. You know, as I think about how you kind of show up as a brand, and obviously, you know, you've built this brand Inseparable. Folks are becoming more familiar with it. You're showing up all across the country. One of the things I really believe is that faces are the new logos, right? And so those stories that you collect, but also the leadership, like you, showing up as a person with a story that can be an advocate, makes a real difference in today's environment. And I know you're out speaking all the time and you show up and share your story. But I wanted to talk about one of the tactics that I know you use to think about how you communicate to your audience, and not always just doing that through a faceless email newsletter. But you have an email that you use. I think you call it "Dear Inseparable Friends." And maybe we can just talk about that, because it's a simple tactic, but it's one that I think is really effective that a leader from any industry could hear about and maybe take something from.
Yeah, you know, for me, authentic communication is incredibly important. And as we were starting Inseparable, if you think about the moment we were in May of 2020, when we're all at home, we're all scared, we're all trying to grasp this new reality we're in. And then we started working in states and working at the federal level and with a really small community of people around Inseparable. And so it was just a casual email that said, here's what we're doing. Here's what seems to be working. Here's where we've fallen flat a few times. And we've just expanded that as we've gone along, but we've not changed the style a bit, even as we've grown. And so You know, this year we're in 18 states pursuing legislation. We're working at the federal level. But I send out a quarterly update to the stakeholders that will say the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it's meant to be a conversation, and it's meant to call out, you know, the partners or individuals who've done great stuff to kind of celebrate them and talk about people on the team that have done smart things, but also to say, hey, guess what? Our piece of legislation in whatever state blew up, and here's why. But what we found is that instead of a lot of, you know, slick materials all the time, people really value like the idea that they're having a conversation with us, and they'll reply back and they'll ask questions. And it's a great tool for me to also understand what's resonating and what's not. But at the end of the day, we believe in, you know, being really transparent about what we're doing, because what we're fighting for is so important. And you just have to tell people this is what's going on. And I just do that as a conversation more than anything else.
Yeah, I love your approach to that, because, you know, obviously this whole show is about the chief executives who are more than that. They are chief influencers. They find a way to break through. And increasingly, I find these examples of authenticity where a leader says, you know, I used to say, yeah, let's put it in the email newsletter, or let's throw it on our company LinkedIn page. But no, now it needs to come from me on the email. It needs to go on my personal page, because people want to hear from other people. And I think in an age where, you know, trust is diminishing, we've all seen lots of research of trust in brands and institutions and so forth going down. Who do people trust? They trust other people. And so building up those personal brands is really essential. So something just like, hey, I'm going to have a quarterly email that's written in a casual, authentic way and come from me. I think that's really inspiring. And it's something that a lot of other folks can learn from. What if somebody wanted to start something like that? What advice would you give them?
Number one is be yourself. And number two is to put yourself in the shoes of the people that are receiving it. And for me, it was a lot of policymakers and philanthropists and people that that just want to know what's going on, right? And so I think just being really clear about letting your personality come through and communicating the way you normally communicate, so that people don't, you know, we all have to do things like annual reports and all of that, and those are important too. But what I've found is that if you just have a channel of information that comes across as fairly unfiltered, it's actually quite important for relationship building and trust building. So I would say just be yourself and think about the people who you're communicating with and what's going to be valuable and helpful for them to hear and understand. Other thing I will say is, my other big rule is to hire people smarter than me all the time, right? And so at Inseparable, we have really, really brilliant people who are leading different parts of the campaign. Give them the mic or the keyboard in this instance, and let them also contribute to those dear Inseparable friends conversation. We've had, you know, our political lead communicate political news. We've had our policy lead communicate some of the policy wins. So it's important that even though I, you know, certainly do have a perspective and a brand as the leader of the organization, what I want is for people to know that the Inseparable community has a lot of people in it who are interested in a conversation with you about what we can all do together.
Yeah. Leaders who share the stage, I think, is just such a great quality. And you have, I've just seen that you do that really well, and like the examples that you just gave. As we wrap up, Bill, I just wanted to ask you, obviously you've worked on a lot of campaigns and, you know, issues in politics. Where are some places that you've gotten, or are there places where you've gotten inspiration for this work outside of that world that you have lived in and operated in for so long?
You know, it sounds pretty basic, but from my dad was an encourager, and he was a small town newspaper editor. And in many ways, he thought his job was to promote the town. But the way it came across on an interpersonal level is he encouraged everyone in his life. And I try to do that, and bring that into the work of Inseparable, because what we're trying to do is encourage people to join and build a movement to transform these systems, not just for the heck of it, because it's going to make people's lives better. So you have to encourage people because it's hard. This is not easy work. And I think that's probably my number one job, is to encourage our team, encourage all the people around us, the policymakers that we interact with, and encourage the people out there who need a better mental health movement to join it and be a part of it, and to show them hope, right? Because at the end of the day, that's what this really is all about, is we want everyone to have hope to live their best life. And so we can't do that without being an encourager.
I love that. What a great way to close. Bill Smith, co-founder of Civitas Public Affairs, which has been involved with major initiatives in the United States, such as marriage equality, now CEO of Inseparable, which in 4 short years has made some tremendous victories around mental health. I think we could call you a chief encourager, probably, Bill, with that last bit of advice. And certainly you're a chief influencer. And we're just grateful that you took time to be with us today, and frankly, for all the wonderful work that you're doing. So thank you so much.
Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Chief Influencer, a production of Social Driver and the Communications Board. If you know a leader who should be featured as a chief influencer, please nominate them at chiefinfluencer.org. For show notes and more, visit us at chiefinfluencer.org or follow Chief Influencer on LinkedIn. Until next time.